Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Uncertainty Dampens Cornerstone's Ploy. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Cary. There's a spirit of celebration in the boardroom, but there are also a couple of big questions looming. Cornerstone Therapeutics CEO Craig Collard leans back in his chair. It's 9:40 a.m., August 6, a few minutes after he presented record drug sales for the second quarter, and he's smiling. Collard, who just told analysts that his Cary-based company boosted its profit margin significantly, has a history in the plush chairs in this conference room on Crescent Green Drive. It's where he and CFO Alastair McEwen strategized to keep up the momentum from acquisition, such as that of the market-ready cystic fibrosis drug Pertzi earlier this year, and that of EKR Therapeutics last year. The product lines from those acquisitions are already feeding earnings results. It's a place of planning, and if nothing else, Collard is a planner. That's why he's so comfortable here. In 2011, when things were holding steady, he and his team planned ahead, making a decision to go acquisition hunting, feeling their resources could be better concentrated in specialty products. But Collard has literally no say in what could be the biggest decision hanging over Cornerstone since it went public via its acquisition of Critical Therapeutics Incorporated in 2008. Majority shareholder Chiesi Pharmaceutici S.p.A. is thinking about buying out the shares it doesn't already own, which would pull Cornerstone from the NASDAQ exchange. Collard says he has no idea what will happen next. And he can't comment on a timeline regarding a decision, nor can McEwen. That's because Collard and McEwen weren't on a special committee that was formed in March to look at the possibilities. The investment bank, Lazard Limited, has been hired as his independent legal counsel in the form of Clifford Chance LLP, but other than those details, updates have been scarce. While questions circulate among the 111 employees, Collard is keeping up his routine, going to work every day and hunting deals. Regardless of the outcome of Chiesi's deal proposal, he says he's confident that life at Cornerstone will carry on. After all, since purchasing a controlling stake in a deal worth $119.3 million in 2009, Chiesi has supported Collard's efforts, loaning Cornerstone an additional $30 million to fund the EKR acquisition last year. And even while in limbo, Chiesi has supported Cornerstone's recent deals, such as the purchase of Pertzi. Collard is confident that he and McEwen can keep up their deal hunting, even as discussions continue behind closed doors. The only frustrating part of the process is the waiting. It's like anything else, he says. The uncertainty out there can be more difficult. Collard, who moved to the Triangle from Louisville, Kentucky in 1999, says Cary is more than the location of Cornerstone's administrative headquarters. It's home, and there are no plans to jump ship or move the company anywhere else. I really love it here, he says. And if Chiesi buys Cornerstone, the only thing that will change is the protocol behind the decision-making process, he says. We're used to doing what I want to do, well, what I and the board want to do, he says, smiling. The order would shift to Chiesi's priorities, which have, McEwen adds, so far been in alignment with Cornerstone's. Neither Collard nor McEwen offers an opinion on an acquisition, though McEwen notes that we've been a private company before, implying that it wouldn't really be anything new. But the numbers are already changing for the management team. Chiesi owned about 15.7 million Cornerstone shares as of Cornerstone's most recent annual report, or about 59% of those outstanding. Collard, who sold 1.6 million shares as part of the Chiesi financing deal in 2009, now owns about 1.6 million shares, or 6% of the company, according to the company's latest securities filing. So there's already been a power shift. It would be pretty hard to go against the majority owner, Chiesi, says Eric Gordon, a professor of business and law at the University of Michigan who follows the biotech industry. Gordon says that excluding Collard and McEwen from the special committee was probably legally necessary to ensure a high value for stockholders without conflict of interest. That conflict extends to Chiesi, which also can't participate on the committee. That committee should be looking at other deals, knocking on doors to create competition and drive value, he adds. Meanwhile, the CEO should do what Collard is doing, keeping calm and carrying on. You really can't stop doing business because you don't know that this other deal will happen, he says. In the meantime, Collard says conversations with potential acquisitions targets are ongoing. And as of June 30, the company had a cash balance of $55.5 million to use for that purpose, not to mention its strong appreciated shares. And as we move down the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, we come to the cover story. And the cover story is headlined, Food Fight. And it includes a large picture of a woman carrying her bags from her cart to her car in the parking lot of a Harris Teeter. The caption reads, Joy Dean is among many Triangle shoppers who will soon have new options. And then under that, the sub-headline, Changes in the retail food business puts billions in play as grocery store chains posture to lure shoppers. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Cary. When Joy Dean grabs her keys and wallet to head out to the grocery store, she has to have a plan. Where Dean lives in West Cary, she has at least six supermarkets in a five-mile radius competing for her attention and her cash, with more store options on the way. Dean is most loyal to Harris Teeter, she says, because of its senior discounts every Thursday, but she buys her meat at the Fresh Market when it's on sale there. Sometimes she'll shop at the nearby Lowe's Foods, Food Lion, or Walmart Neighborhood Market if they have certain grocery list items on sale. I'm in a grocery store about every day, she says, but I'm on a fixed income because both my husband and I are retired, so I go where I find the good prices. New round of posturing. Not since 2005, when the Winn-Dixie supermarket chain closed all 24 stores in its Raleigh-Durham territory, has the Triangle region seen such change in posturing for prime real estate locations among supermarket operators. Walmart, Harris Teeter, Kroger, Food Lion, and Lowe's Foods are all evaluating their options for expanding market share in the Triangle, which has 7,901 residents for each supermarket location. Kroger, Food Lion, and Lowe's Foods have been cutting prices and advertising higher quality products in hopes of boosting sales volumes in an already low-margin business. Harris Teeter and Walmart have been taking a different approach, adding more store locations to attract a broader audience. Harris Teeter plans to open five new stores in the Triangle by the end of its fiscal 2014, even as it prepares for its pending acquisition by Cincinnati-based Kroger Company, the largest traditional supermarket operator in the country. Walmart has in the past 9 months opened a supercenter in Chatham County. And in Cary and in Morrisville, Walmart is opening three neighborhood market stores, a smaller format that's designed to compete more directly with the supermarket chains. The retail giant is also still actively searching for more properties in the region. And the Florida supermarket chain Publix will soon be adding itself to the mix after confirming plans to open its first store in Cary by late 2014. Industry experts expect Publix to add at least four more stores in the region over the next couple of years as the chain strengthens its presence across the state. Grocery frenemies. But even if the Triangle's population continues to grow by 4.8% every 2 years, as it did from 2010 and 2012, there's bound to be some fallout among the grocery chains, analysts say. Profit margin for grocers is about the same as it's always been, 1 to 3% or 1 to 5%, depending on how they are structured, supermarket analyst David Livingston says. But if you only grew 1 to 2%, you really didn't grow. Livingston warns that Walmart and Publix can be formidable forces when they enter a market together. They pretend to be at war with each other, but with Publix on the high end and Walmart on the low end, they use each other to drive out competition, he says, noting that Publix and Walmart helped drive out both Food Lion and Albertsons from the Florida market in recent years. Compared to 20 years ago, Publix and Walmart are bigger than they used to be, and everyone else is a lot smaller than they used to be, Livingston says. Wither the HT brand. Shoppers across the region will also be watching to see what will happen with Kroger's pending $2.4 billion acquisition of Matthews-based Harris Teeter, which is expected to close in the fourth quarter. Harris Teeter has 35 stores in the Triangle. Kroger has 14, but only a couple of pairs of those locations are close enough geographically to compete with each other. Kroger executives have said that customers will notice little change following the merger because Harris Teeter will operate as a subsidiary of Kroger, and they will keep the Harris Teeter brand name on all of its stores. The headquarters and executive management team for Harris Teeter will also remain in the Charlotte area, Kroger says. So any major change between the two brands is likely to happen 4 or 5 years down the road after the dust has settled and when shopping center leases begin to expire. John Farr, Senior Vice President at Regency Centers and owner of shopping center properties across the country, says he expects Kroger to stay true to its word to keep the Harris Teeter brand in North Carolina since it is the more affluent brand and likely to be a more formidable opponent to Publix. In Charlotte, Harris Teeter has such a stronghold that would be counterintuitive to change the name, he says. In Raleigh, it's more likely they might convert some Krogers to Harris Teeter, particularly now that Publix has made its first announcement here. For Joy Dean and Carrie, the more grocery stores competing for her business, the merrier. Where we are located, there are so many new people coming in and so many things being built that I don't think any grocery store will suffer, she says. I think the market can bear it. And there's a second article that's also a part of this cover story. And the headline on this second story is Specialty Grocers Look to Raise Market Share. And this article is also written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a dateline of Raleigh. While the traditional supermarkets duke it out over low prices, specialty grocers like Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, and the Fresh Market have steadily been gaining market share from organic and natural food fans in the Triangle. And that market share could grow further over the next couple of years as more specialty grocers explore expansion opportunities. Real estate sources say the Phoenix-based Sprouts Farmers Market chain, which was in the news last week after its shares more than doubled on their first day of NASDAQ trading, is hunting around for sites in the Triangle and across the southeastern U.S. All of Sprouts' existing stores are west of the Mississippi River, but the company is working on setting up distribution channels on the East Coast to ramp up growth. Its first store announcement in the Triangle could happen within the next 2 years. Monrovia, California-based Trader Joe's, which has its own loyal customer base, has 3 locations in the Triangle, but sources say the company is actively scouting for a site in North Raleigh, particularly near the Interstate 540 interchanges. Trader Joe's spokeswoman Allison Makazuki says the company lists no new locations in the Triangle on its 2-year planning schedule. Greensboro-based The Fresh Market is also making plans to expand its Cameron Village store location. It plans to move all of its prepared food operations to a basement space, which would open up more shopping space on the main level. And while specialty grocers may operate with a much smaller store footprint, they make up for it in high price, high volume sales, says John Farr, Senior Vice President at Regency Centers, a Florida real estate investment trust that owns several shopping centers in the Triangle, including Cameron Village. Whereas a Food Lion grocery store might generate $200 per square foot annually, a Trader Joe's or Whole Foods might generate $1,000 to $3,000 per square foot. The mainline grocers are all competing for moms pushing the big carts around. Trader Joe's is not that way. The Fresh Market is not that way, Farr says. You would never go into a Fresh Market and see a bunch of shopping carts in the checkout line. It's just a different kind of shopping, sort of an impulse grocery shopping experience. The Triangle's 5 largest specialty grocers, with 22 store locations among them, generated about $352 million in sales in 2012, about 7.5% of the Triangle grocery market, according to a report by Chain Store Guide. I wouldn't say it's atypical for a market like yours to have such a diverse grocery market, says Brian List, managing editor and retail market analyst with the industry research group Chain Store Guides. It's already a very diverse, growing, affluent market. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. A quick glance at Triangle happenings. Smith Morning accept Jimmy V invite. The annual Jimmy V Celebrity Golf Classic is coming back to Raleigh, and this time with a bang. Celebrating its 20th season, the Classic will feature more than its typical gala and golf classic. This year, fans can enjoy music during the V-Jam at Red Hot Amphitheater on August 22. This concert will feature alternative music acts, Big Head Todd and the Monsters, The Wailers, Soul Asylum, and Matthew Sweet. Another new event is the V-Fashion Show, presented by Little Black Dress Vodka, held at Zinda Restaurant in downtown Raleigh on August 24. This event will include a celebrity-studded fashion show hosted by Candace Cameron of the 80s family TV show Full House. But if you are a stargazer, then the gala is the place to be. Some of the celebrities scheduled to appear at the gala include NFL legend and Dancing with the Stars champion Emmitt Smith, 7-time Cy Young Award winner Roger Clemens, 7-time NBA All-Star Alonzo Mourning, last season's The Amazing Race winners Anthony and Bates Battaglia, and many more. Underground Drive hits Raleigh streets. Bull City startup space American Underground is expanding again, and this time it's in Raleigh. The startup hub, located at American Tobacco Campus, had recently opened a downtown Durham outpost. Organizers announced a new location at 213 Fayetteville Street in downtown Raleigh. The newest space will feature up to 25 companies as well as Bandwidth Labs, the incubator arm of Republic Wireless parent Bandwidth Incorporated. Dubbed At Raleigh, the building will feature a regional co-working desk allowing startups in the underground to work in any underground location. Local courses make top 100 list. So it's no secret that Biz loves the game of golf, and Biz also loves living in a state that has a plethora of lush stages on which to hit the little white ball. In fact, two North Carolina courses have recently been named among the top 100 courses in the world, but this isn't just any list. These people actually design courses for a living. This ranking, done by industry pub Golf Course Architecture, was compiled from the votes of nearly 250 golf course architects from 28 countries and was the product of its inaugural Architects' Choice ranking. Okay, now on to which Tar Heel State courses made the list. Coming in at number 50 on the list was Sanford's Tobacco Road Golf Course, designed by Mike Strands. The other state representative was, you guessed it, the Donald Ross gem known as Pinehurst No. 2, nabbing the 15th spot on the list. Now, to practice that putting game. Remembering 9/11 through local service. A nonprofit that encourages volunteerism is coordinating a 9/11 day of service, called simply Activate Raleigh 2013. Activate Good and the Downtown Raleigh Alliance want to mobilize 1,500 volunteers to take on nearly 40 service projects to improve the community and help others in remembrance of the September 11, 2001 tragedies. Over 30 charities will participate, including but not limited to an Interfaith Food Shuttle, Note in the Pocket, Interact, and the Boys and Girls Clubs of Wake County. All projects will take place on Wednesday, September 11, 2013, at varying times and locations around Raleigh and the Triangle. This year, Activate Raleigh will also feature an evening activity to provide a service project for those who couldn't take off work during their day. Peanut Revolution, posed by NCSU alums. Do you suffer from peanut butter knuckles? Never fear, a team from North Carolina State University is here. Jar with a Twist, a new company made up of NC State University students and grads, is shopping deals for its idea, a peanut butter jar that acts like a deodorant or lip balm tube, pushing up the peanut butter as it's consumed so you don't have to reach deep into that sticky container. Initially, Chief Innovation Officer Michael Bissett had the idea of a squeegee knife. It's sort of a switchblade, but when the switchblade went into the handle, it would squeegee it clean, explained CFO Spencer Vaughn. While this solves the knuckle problem, it creates a headache for consumers. The kitchen is already full of underutilized and overpriced utensils. If the group really wanted to make peanut butter easier on the consumer, we didn't want there to be something else they'd have to buy. That's when the team decided that if the jar itself solved the problem, consumers could avoid an unnecessary purchase. The company has heard interest from salsa and cosmetic companies. Oh, and we're told a major peanut butter player is also interested. Contributing to Biz were staffers Cameron Snipes, Jason DeBrun, Lauren Onsorge, Dathan Kazuk, and Jesse Burkhardt. And now we turn to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to, the headline, 401k case may force firms to adjust plans. And this article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Cary. Employers of all stripes are adjusting their 401k plans to comply with a court ruling against Fidelity Investments and the electrical equipment company ABB, which both have major operations in Cary. ABB employees had sued the two companies in 2006 under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, with allegations that Fidelity mishandled certain aspects of two of ABB's 401k plans. A federal court in western Missouri ruled last year that the plaintiffs were owed $35.2 million by ABB and $1.7 million by Fidelity. While the two companies' practices have long been common among 401k plans, the court ruled that ran afoul of ERISA in two key ways. First, ABB allowed fund managers to charge higher management fees when lower fee options were available. ABB had a fiduciary duty to get the best possible deal for the participants, the court ruled. It's a duty to invest the money wisely because the assets belong to the participants, says Richard Rogers, an employment attorney with Ryrick Robbins in Raleigh. If the plan sponsor is not careful in choosing funds, its decision may be second-guessed. Durham investment consultant Brent Plunkett says some fund managers have traditionally charged higher percentage fees on smaller groups of employees, both because of bargaining power and because of the higher costs on a per-employee basis. While the decision doesn't directly compel other companies to tweak their plans, many have been doing so in order to avoid similar litigation, Rogers and other ERISA attorneys say. The second mistake, which resulted in the $1.7 million judgment against Fidelity, was that it had been keeping float income, including interest that the plan's cash balances earned in overnight deposits, rather than turning over the earnings to the plans. Interest rates on such overnight deposits are minuscule, but they can build up to substantial amounts over time. ABB and Fidelity are asking the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis to overturn the 2012 ruling. But few companies are holding their breath for that to happen, says Sterling Perkinson, an employment attorney with Kilpatrick Townsend in Raleigh. That's because new regulations from the U.S. Labor Department have provisions that are similar to some of those in the court's ruling. Even if courts ultimately find that ERISA doesn't compel 401k sponsors to tweak their plans, the Labor Department regulations do, Perkinson says. The view that the court took is consistent with what the Department of Labor has been advocating in a number of cases, Perkinson says. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one is for reporter Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. And the first headline, Obamacare penalty. Wake Med Johnston Memorial faced penalties because of readmission rates. Thanks to lower readmission rates, most Triangle hospitals will see a lower Affordable Care Act penalty next year. In fact, only Wake Med Health and Hospitals and Johnston Memorial will pay higher penalties. As part of the ACA, often referred to as Obamacare, hospitals are penalized if a patient is readmitted within 30 days of discharge. Reducing readmissions is one of many ways to reduce overall healthcare spending, and one that hospitals say is largely working. There have been some complaints about the penalty system, however, because hospitals could be charged a penalty for a readmission that is outside their control. Across North Carolina, rural hospitals seem to have higher readmission rates and will therefore pay higher penalties. This trend is true across the nation as hospitals in urban areas can reduce readmissions through clinics or larger doctor networks, among other reasons. Despite seeing its readmissions go up this year, Wake Med has said it is working to reduce the number. Indeed, the hospital will not pay a penalty for the Cary Hospital. This year, Wake Med formed a partnership with Paired Health to help patients transition from hospital to home. In short, Paired Health is designed to be a short-term provider of primary care during the critical 30-day post-discharge phase. It's a team of physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants make house calls and help at-risk patients, often the elderly, continue on the road to recovery. Colleges brace for higher health care costs as ACA rules become effective. Colleges and universities are not immune to determining how the Affordable Care Act affects their ability to provide health insurance to employees, and most in higher ed institutions expect their costs to increase. According to the College and University Professional Association for Human Resources, 2013 Employee Health Benefits in Higher Education Survey, two-thirds of respondents indicated that they had already determined the financial impact of the ACA on their health benefits costs. Of those who have already done the math, 60% expect costs to increase an average of 8%. 40% of respondents expect costs to stay the same after the ACA mandate goes into effect, while no respondents indicated that they expected costs to decrease. The University Professional Association for Human Resources, or called CUPA HR, does not release data from individual universities, but releases who completed surveys. In the Triangle, NC State University and William Peace University were the only to respond. Statewide, 14 colleges and universities responded. Anticipating higher costs has led at least some universities to shift costs to their workforce. More than a quarter of respondents increased the employee's share of premium costs in 2013 in preparation for the now delayed 2014 employer mandate. 23% said they had adopted or enhanced a wellness program, and 17% indicated they had increased the employee's share of dependent coverage costs. Only a quarter of the survey respondents say they have already identified the criteria they will use to determine if part-time or adjunct faculty are working 30 hours or more per week and therefore must be provided health care coverage under the ACA. The majority, 67%, indicated that they are still working on determining those criteria. And the next reporter page is that of Chris Bagley. Bagley covers transportation, law, and energy. The article on this page is headlined, RDU Benefits from Airlines' New Business Plan. A slew of new routes at Raleigh-Durham International Airport is part of a fundamental change in the airline industry's business model as carriers merge and cut capacity on existing routes. In the last 12 months, airlines have introduced or announced new routes to San Francisco, Salt Lake City, Trenton, New Jersey, and the Bahamas, and begun year-round daily flights to Los Angeles. Carriers are also beginning service to Denver and Orlando, which previously were served by only one carrier. Meanwhile, an average of 193 flights took off each day in June, down from 196 in June 2012 and 206 in June 2013. Planes are flying at more than 85% capacity, up from less than 83% in summers past. The tighter ships allowed airlines to raise fares substantially last year, though that has recently shown some signs of easing. Veteran travel agent Tony Maupin says new routes, such as those at RDU, often use planes that have been redeployed from existing routes, where airlines have slimmed their schedules. Maupin also notes that airlines have lately been buying more jets that seat 100 to 300 passengers, such as the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, in place of larger wide-body jets. Each new aircraft entails lower operating costs than most of the larger planes that fly existing routes. So starting a new route represents these less of a risk than it once did, Maupin says. Fares on nonstop itineraries are typically 10% to 40% more expensive than on those with connections, says Jason Lewis, manager at Travel Management Partners in Raleigh. And Lauren Onsorge's page also has one article. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. The headline on the article, KKR Buy of PRA Opens New Doors for Local Ops. Newly acquired contract research organization, PRA International, is bulking up. After a move-heavy summer of acquisitions and an almost public offering, CEO Colin Shannon is positioning the Raleigh company for its future, and it could still be one on Wall Street. In June, PRA, then owned by Genstar Capital, was acquired by Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts & Company, leading leaders to terminate an initial public offering. Genspire needed to really exit the investment, explained Shannon, and they wanted to make sure it was a successful exit. The IPO? A backup plan, he says, in case the price expectations weren't met. And life since acquisition? Delightful, he says. Delightful because KKR is planning the firm's future, recently having announced that PRA would merge with Pennsylvania-based RPS. The combined company, under Shannon's control, offers a more comprehensive service package and one that could be better prepared for a public market in the next few years. Bulk, Shannon explains, is one thing missing, and its absence is why an IPO this summer wasn't ideal. I'll be honest, he says, I felt we were just a little too small. We would be the smallest of all the publicly traded CROs, and that didn't work for me, because we'd be giving away a lot of information and people could use that against us. But he still has his eye on Wall Street. I feel much more confident next time, he says. Obviously, the plan is to continue the growth. We have actually combined two companies that are both growing substantially. We see the strength of both companies will help accelerate our total growth. Ward and Smith attorney Jim Verdonik says small companies do face problems on the public market, particularly in attracting analyst attention. If you don't get that, then you're public in theory, but few people know about you, he explains. And along with lacking analysts, you may lack institutional investors who typically buy shares in bulk, but don't want that buy to be a large percentage of the company. They want to get in, but they want to get out, Verdonik says. What's the sense of owning public stock as opposed to private stock if they can't sell it? If the percentage of ownership is too high, a sale decreases in the stock price. Add in the fact that going public costs money. If you have more revenue, you can spread that out, and going public can be a risky move for companies PRA's size, Verdonik adds. It's definitely a tough world for a small public company, he reiterates, but on the other hand, when you raise money in an IPO, you get it cheaper than if you raise it from private investors. Additionally, IPOs give smaller companies better access to management due to public stock option benefits, as well as more visibility. PRA moved to Raleigh about 5 years ago from Reston, Virginia. We started with two, now we have over 500, Shannon says, adding that the company is committed to Raleigh. Merger plans are still being hashed out, but there's a strong possibility some RPS personnel may be moving to the Triangle. And RPS may not be the last company to add to PRA's bulk. It may be a while before we do anything like this again, he says, but it's great to be off with such a great start. And now we turn to the A Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we have Todd Cohen's column, the headline on it, Working with Public Schools to Foster Empowerment Through Music. In the school year that begins this month, 300 students in public elementary schools in Durham County and 60 in Wake County who otherwise could not afford it will be playing in a free symphony program thanks to Kids Notes, that's spelled K-I-D-Z-N-O-T-E-S, a Durham nonprofit modeled on the pioneering El Sistema program. Formed in 1975 to bring music to impoverished kids in the slums of Venezuela, El Sistema has reached 800,000 children throughout the world. El Sistema is rooted in the idea that music could change the social and economic circumstances, that music could be a means of empowerment out of poverty, says Katie Wyatt, executive director of Kids Notes. Founded in 2010 by Durham philanthropist Lucia Poe, Kids Notes this fall will include 5 low-income schools in Durham and 3 in Wake. To cover the cost of $2,500 per student, the nonprofit raises money from individuals, foundations, events, and corporate partnerships. Kids Notes collaborates with the public schools, which provide free space and cover the cost of music teachers who team teach with 25 part-time music instructors who work with the nonprofit as independent contractors. It also partners with the East Durham Children's Initiative, a collaboration of dozens of agencies that support families and children in a 120-block area east of downtown Durham. And it collaborates with arts groups throughout the Triangle that provide the kids with free tickets to events. We've accomplished what we've been able to accomplish because we've worked as a collaborative organization, Wyatt says. At Kids Notes, which operates with an annual budget of $650,000 and a staff of 4 people, every student begins in kindergarten at the beginning, or Mozart level, by learning to play the violin and read music, spending 10 hours a week in classes after school and Saturdays. Starting in first grade, students, through auditions, can advance to the intermediate or Brahms level, learning different instruments and spending 10 hours a week at a central nucleo after school and weekends that brings together students from different schools to practice together in a symphony setting. Students eventually can progress to the advanced or Beethoven level. Parents learn to play along with their children, and their participation is critical, Wyatt says. Every parent who has a kid learning to play an instrument knows that home practice is key to success and advancement, she says. Music has become part of their lives. Kids Notes, one of 80 El Sistema programs in the U.S., aims to expand to 500 students in Durham in 3 years and to 500 students in Wake in 5 years, and eventually would like to operate throughout the state. The public schools also are tracking the Kids Notes students' grades, attendance, behavior, and end-of-year testing, and comparing them to those of public school students overall in the same grades. Music instruction significantly enhances the executive function of the brain, Wyatt says. The El Sistema movement is an energizing, active, involved movement of many, many people coming behind the idea that music has the power to change lives. And in the nonprofit news, Comfort Zone Camp, a camp to give hope to grieving children, has received a $25,000 grant from the New York Life Foundation to provide camp for children who have lost a parent or sibling. The NYL Community Impact Grant Program awards up to $25,000 to local nonprofits that address the needs of the community. A total of 260 grants worth more than $3.1 million have been awarded since the program's inception. This grant will allow North Carolina children to attend CZC at Camp Kanata free of charge. William Peace University in Raleigh says the William R. Keenan Jr. Charitable Trust has awarded the institution's Mary Lilly Keenan Scholarship with a $170,000 grant. A long-standing endowment for William Peace University, the scholarship was founded in 1991 by the William R. Keenan Jr. Charitable Trust in honor of Mary Lilly Keenan, a sister of William R. Keenan Jr. and an 1896 graduate of the Peace Institute. Wells Fargo, through its Wells Fargo Housing Foundation and Women's Team Member Network, will provide $15,000 and volunteer support in partnership with Rebuilding Together to help make a home safe and healthy for a family of 4 in Holly Springs. The Wells Fargo Housing Foundation was created to provide permanent solutions to home ownership needs in Wells Fargo communities nationwide. And in the People on the Move section, Richard Stevens, an attorney at Smith Anderson, Blunt, Dorset, Mitchell, and Jernigan, LLP, was named to the statewide board of directors of the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. And Sally Webb, CEO of the Special Event Company, was named to Teen Cancer America's board of directors. And now we turn to the Spotlight page in the Triangle Business Journal. And two short articles. The first one is headlined, Making a Career Out of Circus. And this is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Raleigh. Running away to the circus need only take you as far as the warehouse district of downtown Raleigh. That's where, in the Hugh Building on Hargett Street, sisters Sarah Phoenix and Cheryl Howell are coming up on the one-year anniversary of Cirque de Vol Studios, the Triangle's first and only circus school. Complete with trapeze fitness classes, fire dancing, and yoga offerings, Cirque was a long time coming, says Cheryl, a North Carolina State graduate and Raleigh native. We just combined forces, she says. Cheryl has the business training, and Sarah, a lifelong artist, had been teaching and managing classes and workshops. The pair pooled their savings and added it to a $10,000 fundraiser on the crowdfunding site Indiegogo. Hugh was chosen because of its high ceilings, ideal for the supports the team installed for the silks and trapeze equipment. It's a gamble, as performance studios across the state have faced funding crises over the past few years. Most recently, North Carolina Shakespeare Festival in High Point suspended operations due to funding constraints. But it's a gamble the sisters are willing to bank on, literally. Our lives are in this, Sarah says, adding that Raleigh is more than part of the business plan. It's her home. And to be successful here, they've turned to the business community, offering 30-minute lunch hour yoga classes and corporate bonding workshops to keep afloat. While that and the kids' camps are among the more popular options, Cirque also produces performances and last year put on 12 shows for First Night Raleigh. Throw in the typical 30 to 40 classes a week, and the pair are creating a niche following. They're also attracting contracted talent, such as trapeze instructor and actor Samantha Corey, who recently returned to her hometown after a theatrical stint in Colorado. Corey, who got her start via First Flight in New York, teaches adult trapeze fitness classes, though it's not what she saw herself doing while studying performance at Appalachian State University a few years ago. I always thought I wasn't very physical, she laughs. I thought there is no way I would be able to be upside down like that. But now it's a passion. I think circus arts in general are really an amazing way to view life, she says. You have to put in the time to practice, but it's not a painful process. It's like being a kid again playing on a playground. Sarah says that playfulness is a big part of the appeal, as is overall fitness. There are really incredible life skills, she says. The stress relief, the stress management, the team building, and it's really fun. And the next article, NC Symphony introduces music to local children. Parents of young children looking to get their little ones involved in music at an early age now have a great opportunity to do so thanks to the North Carolina Symphony. With a $50,000 grant award to the symphony, courtesy of PNC Bank, children have a chance to hear from members of the symphony, as well as participate in a hands-on instrument zoo. The zoo offers the children a chance to pick up an instrument of their liking to see if music is for them. On August 5, symphony violinist David Kilbride entertained about 60 children and their parents with a reading of the Lodi Moss picture book, Zin Zin Zin, a Violin. The North Carolina Symphony Music Discovery is designed for preschool children and their families and will feature a handful of other symphony musicians during the month of August in six regional library locations in Wake County throughout the 2013 to 2014 season. And now we turn to the small business section, where it concerns Southern Season. The headline on the article, with investors on board, store explores out-of-state expansion. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun. Most chefs in the Triangle, amateurs and professionals alike, know of Southern Season in Chapel Hill. It's a grocery store, not a traditional one, but rather one that has all kinds of specialty items to help chefs give their meals a little something extra. Founded in 1975, the store has grown from a footprint of 800 square feet to a 60,000 square foot space in University Mall, as well as an online catalog operation that ships from a warehouse in Hillsboro. We've been a landmark destination for quite some time now, says Brian Favor, Southern Season's chief operating officer. The store was founded by Michael Barefoot, though he sold it 2 years ago, to TC Capital Fund, headed by Chapel Hill entrepreneur Clay Hamner, for an undisclosed price. TC Capital Fund is a joint venture of Carborough Capital Corporation and Tryon Capital Ventures, LLC, both of Chapel Hill. The founders of Carborough Capital are Chapel Hill residents, Clay Hamner, Betty Keenan, and Phil Phillips. The founders of Tryon Capital are Pete Coker and Peter Rickard. Tryon Capital is also headquartered in Chapel Hill. Although everything in the store is under one roof, shoppers really go through different sections. There is the coffee section, for example, which features various exotic beans, or the prepared foods and deli section for dinner ideas. Of course, it also has the in-store restaurant, where shoppers can eat a meal or buy a prepared meal to eat later. The store also has thousands of specialty cooking utensils that include all kinds of kitchen gadgets. Some people call us a hardware store for foodies, Favor says with a laugh. Southern Season has been featured in a publication by Travel and Leisure, Southern Living, and Gourmet Retailer, and on the Food Network. It was honored by the National Association for Specialty Food as its Outstanding Retailer of the Year, and by Gourmet News with its Retail Achievement Award for its success in the area of food education. The late New York Times food critic Craig Claiborne once described Southern Season as wall-to-wall and floor-to-ceiling of visual and gustatory delight. One of the biggest ways Southern Season aims to differentiate itself is on service. Grocery stores largely operate on a volume, but Favor says he wants employees to focus on service. We want you to interact with our staff while you're shopping, he says. We have a lot of items that you might not have seen. They might be from small craft stores or a specialty purveyor that is not being advertised, but our staff can teach you about the items we have. Staff go through training, but Favor said most of the people who apply are foodies themselves and already have a working knowledge of a lot of the items in the store. Also, Southern Season encourages vendors to set up displays throughout the store in which they educate shoppers and staff alike on a new product. Indeed, on their website, the store advertises that shoppers will enjoy various samples while shopping. Looking ahead, Favor says Southern Season wants to expand its brand. It's not the kind of retailer to put more than one store in a city, but the investment group already announced it will open stores in Charleston, South Carolina, and Richmond, Virginia. The company is also considering sites in Charlotte, Birmingham, Alabama, Atlanta, Nashville, Tennessee, Palm Beach, Florida, and Naples, Florida. And now we'll turn to the Washington Watch. This is a column written by Kent Hoover. And Kent Hoover is chief of TBJ's Washington Bureau. U.S. wins WTO case against China over duties on chicken products. The U.S. has won its second World Trade Organization case against China over duties imposed on American products, this time on chicken products. A WTO panel found that China violated WTO rules when it imposed anti-dumping duties and countervailing duties on chicken imports from the U.S. The U.S. previously won a case against China over duties imposed on specialty steel products. It also is pursuing a case against China over subsidies it provides to its auto industry. U.S. exports of these chicken products to China fell by 80% after China imposed higher duties on them. This decision sends a clear message that the Obama administration can fight and win for American farmers, businesses, and workers in the global trading system ensuring that America gets the benefit of the rules and market access we have negotiated in our international trade agreements, said U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman. WTO members must use trade remedies strictly in accordance with their commitments, and we hope that this win will discourage further violations that hurt American exporters. We look forward to seeing China's market for broiler products restored, said Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. This is an important victory today for the U.S. poultry industry and for American farmers and ranchers. Senate confirms 5 NLRB nominees. Business hopes new board will be fair. The National Labor Relations Board is back at full strength thanks to the Senate's confirmation of 5 nominees. Labor unions are pleased, business groups not so much. This is the first time in more than a decade that the NLRB has been fully staffed, said AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka. That is good news for all workers seeking to exercise the rights they are guaranteed by law. President Barack Obama also welcomed the confirmations, which concluded a bipartisan agreement reached to move forward on long-stalled presidential nominations. And with our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. ACC adds 5 more bowl games. The Atlantic Coast Conference announced 5 more bowl partnerships for postseason play through 2019. The various agreements mean that the ACC would send a minimum of 9 teams to bowl games each year, provided at least 9 are bowl eligible. It could send as many as 12, though that would be a very tight scenario, and only if 2 ACC teams advance to the new college football playoff. An unlikely scenario for any conference, except maybe the powerhouse SEC. Court, Peace U can buy Seaboard Station. A bankruptcy court has approved the sale of Seaboard Station Shopping and Restaurant Center to its neighbor, William Peace University. Seaboard's owners, Gregory and Parker Incorporated, and a related company have been in Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization since February of 2012. The court approved the $20.75 million sale on Friday. Campbell opens doors to new medical school. The Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine held its first classes on August 6, becoming the first medical school to open in North Carolina in 35 years. The school, which has a mission to prepare students to serve as primary care doctors in rural or underserved areas, has 162 members in its inaugural class. Graduates from Campbell will practice as doctors of osteopathic medicine, as opposed to those from other medical schools in the area that graduate medical doctors. Both are equally licensed in North Carolina. Two Raleigh office buildings could fetch $46 million. Two office buildings near the PNC Arena are poised for a $45.75 million sale to Prudential real estate investors. The two 100,000-square-foot Class A buildings and about 20 acres of surrounding land have been in limbo since February 2012, when developer Harry Lichten put the property into bankruptcy amid loan renegotiations with BB&T. The bank sold the loans to an affiliate of Goldman Sachs, which has since been trying to wrest the property from Lichten. Salix expanding its North Raleigh headquarters campus. Salix Pharmaceuticals has signed a deal at its headquarters campus in North Raleigh to lease all the remaining vacant office space in the Colonnade 1 building and expand its contract terms through 2023. Salix now occupies about 187,000 square feet of office and research space in the two Colonnade office buildings on Six Forks Road. Both buildings are now 100% occupied. Salix this week had signed an extension to its 42,949-square-foot lease at Colonnade 1, in addition to a 16,749-square-foot expansion in the building, according to a news release from the building's private equity ownership group, KBS Realty Advisors of Newport Beach, California. Both leases run through 2023. Wake Med to close two nursing facilities. Citing millions in lower reimbursements, Wake Med Health and Hospitals announced it would close two skilled nursing facilities. During the next 2 months, Wake Med will suspend skilled nursing services at the Fuquay Arena Outpatient and Skilled Nursing Facility and the Zebulon Wendell Outpatient and Skilled Nursing Facility. The move affects 97 workers, including 66 who had three-quarter or full-time spots. Wake Med said it would work to find those employees other positions in the hospital system if possible. And also in this section of the Triangle Business Journal, they run a poll each week that's done online, and we'll quickly explain that poll. The question for last week's poll: North Carolina's corporate incentive package, necessary or no? And to that question, there were 370 responses, and 43% say absolutely, it's another tool that helps in recruitment. Another 44% say no, firms that, like North Carolina, would relocate, expand here anyway. And the final 13% say they don't know enough about North Carolina's incentive policy. And the question for next week is, in the past 40 years, whose vision has most significantly changed your life? And the results will be in next week's edition. But we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal, so we'll stop right here. But be sure to listen at the same time next week, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.